The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I may ultimately get a play in terms of the price of silver moving higher, but in the interim, I'm expanding my asset base, my ounce base. That's something we do. It's something that we can help facilitate for a client. If you don't know us, that's a way that you should get to know us, because it's how we add value. Cheapest in the industry? Absolutely not. Best at adding value? I think so.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, I hope everybody had a great Christmas a couple of days ago, and we're also wishing everyone a Happy New Year, all of our listeners.
Yeah, no, it's been an interesting thing going through 2017, now looking at 2018, and we are in that period of reflection, I guess, when we want to know what to anticipate for 2018, but also take account of what this year held for us. And I'd say some of the highlights for us were the conferences, getting to see our clients and spend time with them. This is the first time in a decade that my dad has been back in the States and meeting with us and our clients. So that was a real highlight for me.
Well, you know, another highlight, I loved doing that. Another highlight is the show just keeps growing. You know, our subscribership on the YouTube channel and in other places, more and more people are listening to the weekly commentary. We're very grateful for that.
And at these conferences, we met a lot of people that we'd never known before. So the listeners to the commentary that, you know, are now sort of checking us out as a company to do business with, having vetted us for years through listening and getting to know us that way, now spending some one-on-one time with us. And that was great too, to get to know new friends.
Well, and you know, it's interesting to sometimes look back and say, all right, is my perception matching reality? You know, I've heard people calling me this week and saying, gosh, when is gold going to go up? And it's like, well, you know, it really wasn't a bad year. Gold, you know, putting on about a 10% gain is not a necessarily a bad year, but we had a real win in the market that I think most people don't actually get a chance to see. We saw a tripling using one of our ratio trades this year, Dave, the palladium to platinum swap.
Yeah, and it is interesting. Being in the business now for 45 years in the precious metals business, we go back to 2008 and 2009, and the market was not particularly friendly, particularly in the fall of 2008.
Right.
But in that time frame, we had the opportunity to put two things in place, one of which we harvested this year, and one of which was actually harvested there in November, December of 2008. In the middle of the global financial crisis, premiums on junk bags went to 35%, and we did our classic bag-to-bar swap, netting a large number of ounces for clients, which we had positioned for ahead of time.
Just getting more silver. I mean, going from silver to silver, but just gaining almost a third extra silver.
Exactly. And to me, I think this is, as people get to know us, not only through the commentary, but in terms of the acumen of the guys and gals in the office, what value they can add, that would be an example. And you mentioned something that we did this year, which in spite of silver being relatively flat and gold only putting up 10%, you know, what do we have? We have the platinum palladium trade, which has allowed us this year to harvest a tripling in ounces.
That is amazing. So without having to go out of the metals, a person could have tripled from palladium to platinum just by owning from 2008 to 2017.
Well, and that's the point. In the context of that crunch, 2008 and 2009, we were doing things proactively. Now, how long did it take to benefit from that? We are patient. And these are the things that we do look for as opportunities. But here, I mean, a tripling of ounces from palladium now going to platinum, these are the kinds of things we like to put in motion as we structure a portfolio. And I tell you what, if you don't know someone in our office, call it a shameless plug, but I think you should get to know some of the best guys and gals in the metals industry in terms of adding value.
Right.
Appreciate the idea of stacking ounces, but how you do that can be done in such a way that adds value and ultimately adds ounces to what you have if you structure a portfolio correctly on the front end.
Well, and there's nothing wrong with buying and holding. I mean, gold has been a great investment if you just buy it and hold it. But there are ways, like you said, that you can compound. That's what we call it, compounding ounces. And granted, okay, maybe you're only going to get a compounding ounce opportunity a couple of times a decade. But gosh, if you can double or triple, just like we were talking about the palladium to platinum swap. Okay, so yeah, it took 8 or 9 years to triple the platinum that a person owned.
That's triple.
That's tripling. But what are we doing? We actually set the client up for the next doubling or tripling in the next 5 to 8 years, because we'll go back into that palladium when it falls back down.
The beauty is we're tripling on what was already tripled. So you begin to see the monstrous gains in terms of compounded ounces as you go.
Well, this takes me to the first question that our listeners are asking. We promised last week that we would read some of the YouTube comments that have been coming through. We often do read them. We just don't have time to reply to them online. But today, what we want to do is we want to address some of the questions that some of our loyal listeners have. And I'll just start with this first question because it ties right into what we were talking about with 2008. The question says, tell me something. In 2008, gold and silver ETFs and miners went down just as much as the stock market. So is gold and silver really a safe haven? That's an interesting question, Dave, because initially when the stock market did crash, gold and silver miners went down just like it did in 1987.
Well, and gold and silver miners also went down in the 1929 crash as much as the stock market did. Now, by 1937, they had recovered far more than the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So they did take on something of a safe haven appeal with a few more people stepping in and buying them. So from bottom to top, you had the Dow Jones Industrial Average from 32 to 37 up 400%, and Placer and Homestake and some of the other miners at the time up over 500%,
right,
outperforming. And we saw the same thing in 2008 and 9, the initial sell-off in gold was a consequence of indiscriminate selling. What immediately returned after October, November, as we headed into December, was more discriminate thinking. So again, from indiscriminate selling to more discriminate thinking, as soon as people sort of regained some rationale, and it wasn't just panic selling, then all of a sudden they said, well, what do I want to own? And oh, by the way, if this includes counterparty risk and the potential demise of the financial system, where do we want assets? We want assets in a financial product that is not subject to the financial system, and otherwise it's outside of the financial system. So I guess really to the question, and this is Arturo's question, is gold a perfect hedge? No, it's not, and it's not supposed to be, but that's different than being a safe haven. And a safe haven can be sold off, again, in the context of indiscriminate selling. What we count on with a safe haven is that any at all, discriminate thinking returns rational thinking and returns a rational buyer back to the marketplace and says, wait a minute, what are my real risks here? So where we saw a buoying of price in the tail end of 2008 and into the first quarter of 2009, gold and silver did prove themselves a safe haven. I think the question then is really, is gold and silver a perfect hedge? And you'd have to say, no, it's not a perfect hedge, but it is a safe haven.
Right, right. And I do remember those crashes. You know, 1987, gold went down, and then it immediately came back up and gave gains by the end of the year, you know, the October crash. Same thing with 2008. If you wanted gains, you needed to be in gold. This is probably one of the reasons why we don't encourage leverage for gold shares or gold, because if the market were to crater, if you were leveraged, you'd get wiped out like everybody else, even though gold turned out to be the better investment weeks later. Well, I'm going to go with a question, Dave, that a lot of people have been asking now that Janet Yellen has given her final speech. What impact will Powell have at the Federal Reserve in 2018?
You know, I think I would reference the Credit Bubble Bulletin. If people want to go to our wealth management website, our sister company, McIlvany Wealth Management, read Doug Nolan's comments on Powell. This goes back about a month ago, and I think he did a good job of exploring the positives and negatives of Powell. My view is that this was a reasonable decision by the central bank community to say, we don't really want much to change. We don't want any real radical shifts. What has been in place should probably stay in place. So Powell is most likely going to continue on the same themes that were put in place by both Bernanke and Yellen before him.
This is definitely not a Volcker coming in, and even John Taylor would have represented more of a Volcker type of entrance, but Powell is more
exactly right.
Don't rock the boat.
Well,
right?
And given the connection between monetary policy and current asset pricing, the asset markets have said essentially the same thing. They would agree with me that there's really no disruption that's going to occur in 2018. Had we brought in John Taylor, there would have been a certain number of disciplines, perhaps introduced and that might have been disruptive to the current props that are in place in the asset markets through monetary policy.
Going to a question from Mina, she said, I look forward to your weekly commentary, and I appreciate all that you do to help us understand what's going on with the economy. However, I still have a problem understanding if there's unlimited supply of currency to prop up the various segments of the economy, how can things possibly change for the better here in the United States? If I had a legal currency printing press, I would not be concerned about how much debt I was accumulating because the debt can be paid with the currency I create out of thin air. You know, if you think about it, it's like me choosing to charge a purchase to my credit card when I have more than enough currency to pay for it up front. In other words, I could have used my debit card, but chose to use my credit card instead. What do you guys think? I can see there being a problem globally because other countries could decide not to accept our currency or vice versa. Thanks again.
You know, when you look at the debt markets and you look at our currency system, there really is a common meeting point, and it is that people continue to have confidence in that system. And so you can do a lot in terms of an increase in expansion of the monetary supply, monetary base, that you can increase the total stock of debt. And it really is just feathering around that perception by the investment community and other central banks as to whether or not you are still stable, if you're going to stay in some sort of a stable trajectory. So that's what you're playing with, is confidence. You can't do too much on the debt side or too little. You can't do too much on the currency printing side or too little. And to the last point, where there's a suggestion of currency repudiation, where countries might not accept our currency, I think one of the things to think about too is that we already have close to 65% of our currency float, which is outside of the United States. That's roughly $580 billion in actual currency, which is in circulation in other parts of the world. And part of that is that it is a favored currency. We have had the world reserve currency status. And a part of that is the consequence of what's called dollarization. Dollarization is where a country looks at its own currency and says, you know, we don't really do a very good job of managing our own currency. Why don't we just use the U.S. dollar instead of our currency? And they literally get rid of theirs and use U.S. dollars on a domestic basis. Right. So that brings in a huge number. Again, 65% of all of our currency outstanding is overseas through dollarization and just, you know, sitting in banks. Certainly, it's a part of the trade relations that we have with China and the petrodollar relations that we've had into the Middle East. That float is pretty significant.
So there's a necessity to maintain confidence. It's not just here in America they have to maintain confidence. They have to do it worldwide.
Well, that's right. And where you begin to see a change in the currency structure is when that confidence begins to ebb. So go back to an earlier period of time, and in the 1960s, late 1960s, you began to see confidence erode with the U.S. dollar because what we were saying and what we were doing were two very different things. Mm. The French financial attaché to Charles de Gaulle, whose name was Jacques Rouff, had been around for the sterling devaluation in the 1930s. And so it was an older codger at that point and sort of bellowing, not just whispering, but bellowing into de Gaulle's ear that what we were saying was not consistent with what we were doing. That is the United States and our monetary and fiscal policies. And that ultimately this promise to pay gold or dollars we would renege on, he saw it coming. And starting at about 60, I forget if it was 66 or 67, de Gaulle wouldn't pay attention to him. Mm. So he started publishing his thoughts in Le Monde, the daily paper there in Paris. And all of a sudden, de Gaulle was listening because he had a popular and public audience for these ideas. And they started pulling gold from the U.S., which ultimately precipitated the 71 closure of the gold window. Why do I mention that? Because it really is a confidence game. And whatever system it is, whether it's the post-Bretton Woods system, the monetary system that Rouff and de Gaulle were responding to, this is a foreign country who is now saying, we don't believe you anymore.
Right.
And we don't like what you're doing in terms of fiscal policies and monetary policies, and we have to protect our interests. We are willing to jeopardize being a quote-unquote friend of the United States and become, theoretically, an enemy by not complying with your wishes, as long as we protect our own interests. So it was a nationalist-driven thing.
Wouldn't you say, Dave, that debt is a lot like gravity? It can't be defied for forever. You know, Mina is talking about, what if you could just go into debt for forever, since you can print the currency and print your way out of it? I think it's important to look at history and see that there's never been a paper currency that was based on debt that has survived the long term. I mean, debt always, it's just like gravity. I mean, at some point, it's going to pull things back down to their normal levels.
Yeah, and I think this is really dealing with thresholds. Again, whether it's thresholds of confidence or what you and I have talked about in the past, you put enough sand on a pile and the pile grows and grows and grows until you have a sudden, seemingly spontaneous collapse. And what is the trigger? Well, frankly, you could say it's just gravity. You put too much mass onto a pile and there was all kinds of fractures and fissures unperceived under the surface, and ultimately you see a slide off of that sand pile. That's what you would call catastrophe math, right? So when you have a catastrophe, everything seems normal until the moment where it's no longer normal. That is where, again, you don't want to tempt the fates. Yes, Mina, you can do this. You can continue to print money to pay, or if you choose, which would be, I mean, your choice, credit or debit. But in either case, you don't want to tempt the fates. Printing and expansion of debt both have limits. Do I know what those limits are? No, because it's not just a monetary threshold. You can't say, according to the math, this is where it collapses, because the threshold is a sociological or psychological, and maybe we should reverse that. It's a psychological, and then ultimately it expresses itself as a sociological phenomenon where people in mass begin to say, okay, we're going to change our behavior because of what we see. And again, it goes right back to that erosion of confidence.
All right. Now, there's two questions that sort of tie side by side. I'm going to ask the first one and then sort of lead you into the second one as well, because two different listeners. The first one said, I wonder, if we had a monetary collapse, will coins rule the day? And will paper money end up worthless? Now, before you answer that, let me ask the second question, because I think you can tie it together. This one's from Eli. He said, I've bought both American Eagles and silver rounds over the last 3 years. But in your opinion, does it make sense to just start buying trusted silver generic rounds over the American silver Eagles? Just thinking of a more bang for the buck movement. So, two questions. Will coins rule the day over paper money? And if we were bartering on the street, is it better to just have silver rounds or American silver Eagles? Dave, what's your thought?
I think on the first question, yes, in a final analysis, coins rule the day, but there's stages at which that would not be the case. What makes the current economy in the world as we know it operate used to be strictly oil. It was, you know, you could look and say oil was this dominant factor and it kept the economy going. Now you could almost say that information is more important than oil to the modern economy, but information has to flow, and it's not through newspapers and news channels, you know, Fox or CNN. We're talking about fiber optic cables. We're talking about data transfers, and these are areas of real vulnerability, because when you talk about a monetary collapse, our current monetary system is an information-driven monetary system. Compromise that at all, and all of a sudden you see the popularity in paper cash emerge. You know, and we've mentioned this in the last year or so, where actually here in Durango, Colorado, we've lost connectivity for a 48 to 72-hour period, given the remote nature of where we live. It's a small town, and occasionally somebody hits a fiber cable, and you don't have connectivity anymore. Right. And even a large bank like Wells Fargo can't check your balance and won't give you your money because they can't verify what you had on account.
So you couldn't charge, you couldn't use your debit card, and you really couldn't even get cash. If you didn't have cash, you didn't go to the movies that night.
Right, and the ATM's not going to deliver anything to you either, because they can't verify your account balance. So what I'm talking about is stages. Monetary collapse, the first stage is one that's sort of informationally driven, where you may see a migration to actually paper money and sort of a resurgence of popularity or required use of paper assets, paper money.
And that may last a week or two, like we saw in Egypt when Mubarak was being overthrown.
Yeah, no, there's nothing that says that that doesn't either cause additional problems, or maybe that solves the problem.
Right.
But if it doesn't solve the problem and you go to the next stage where there's a compromise of integrity or a, again, loss of confidence in the paper money system, now you're looking at alternatives. What are your alternatives to the paper money system? Assuming digital is dead and the information-driven system is no longer working, paper money is compromised just on the basis of people's belief or lack lack thereof in that system, what comes next? I mean, it doesn't have to be coins. It doesn't have to be gold and silver. It could be something else. I think what we're dealing with is the reliability through time of gold and silver. And I mean, you can take this back to Genesis chapter 2,
right,
and the first mention of gold and God saying, this is good. There has been an understanding of gold for 5,000 years of recorded history as a means of stored wealth and an object that allows you to convey that value from one party to the other. So do I think that you can convey value in other terms? Sure, you can with whiskey, cigarettes, tampons, toilet paper. You tell me what you need and there's going to be a value exchange which occurs, and it doesn't have to require gold and silver.
It's just gold is a little bit more universal.
And it's also something that is relatively indestructible. So, you know, that's, I think, one of the reasons why it has been the, as Alan Newman said, the cash of last resort. And so, I mean, if we're really talking about the cash of last resort in the context of a monetary collapse, where would I want to be? Yes. Now, to go to Eli's question, if it's bang for the buck movement that Eli's asking about, you know, I would approach it a different way completely. I mean, I like Maple Leafs. I like Mexican onzas. You know, two of my boys came in with greenbacks two nights ago and wanted to exchange for silver ounces again. And they've figured out my matching program is really the sweetest
program
deal going. It's 100% gain for them,
yeah,
out of the shoot. And they're no fool on that one.
Right.
Maybe I am, but they're not. So best bang for the buck. Unfortunately, I can't extend that offer to our clients to immediately double your ounces, but I would keep that mindset there, because what we mentioned just a few minutes ago, Kevin, about owning junk silver versus 100 or 1,000 ounce silver bars, I don't like junk silver necessarily. I mean, I'd much rather look at a Maple Leaf or an American Silver Eagle if it was just coming to a beauty contest.
Right.
But pragmatically, if we're down to bang for the buck, why wouldn't you own cheap silver,
right,
that also gives you the ability to capture the premium gain and translate that into new and free ounces?
Right.
So my opinion, you're never going to get that with a generic silver round, whereas occasionally you do with junk silver. So if it's bang for the buck, it's going to be dimes, quarters, and 50 cent pieces. If you want to know what's in my portfolio, it's dimes, quarters, and 50 cent pieces. I converted this year my last 100 ounce silver bars into junk silver because the premium was, again, near spot, and I know that the premiums on junk can rise to 15, 20, even 35%.
Right.
That means on the next go-round, I'm going to increase my total stock of silver by 10, 15, 20, even 35%. That to me is bang for the buck, because I may ultimately get a play in terms of the price of silver moving higher, but in the interim, I'm expanding my asset base, my ounce base. That's something we do. It's something that we can help facilitate for a client. If you don't know us, that's a way that you should get to know us, because it's how we add value. Cheapest in the industry? Absolutely not. Best at adding value? I think so.
Yeah, and it does take experience. A lot of the guys here have been here longer than 30 years. So, all right, I'm going to go on to the next question. When will banks accept bullion, Dave? Is that a necessary question, or do banks even need to be involved in the transaction?
You know, I think it's unlikely. Returning to a gold standard is not likely. If you look at today's zeitgeist or the ideas that are behind our monetary and banking system, they don't really like gold. And a lot of that zeitgeist has been influenced by Barry Eichengreen, his book, Golden Fetters. We have a generation of PhDs, and even if you didn't study economics formally, I can tell you the economic impressions that you get by the practitioners as it trickles down to the man on the street through media and other sources is ultimately an anti-gold bias that comes from Barry Eichengreen and his book Golden Fetters, because he basically says, look, we wouldn't have had the Great Depression if it hadn't been for the gold standard, which is totally, in my opinion, a specious argument, and he conveniently lines up some facts to support it, ignores much of the 19th century and the benefits of the deflationary, which just last week we talked about. You know, there are benefits to the common man and the man on the street to have prices coming down. That's okay. It's like an increase in purchasing power for the dollars that you have. But, you know, the banking system is dead set against that. The banking system is in favor of an expansion of debt. Why? Because debt to a banker is an asset. And the more assets that he has out in the system collecting interest on those assets, he's in favor of it, right? So when you go back to the idea of bullion being a part of the system, it is inherently limiting to the banker, whether it's the commercial banker or the central banker.
Right.
And again, maybe in the context of a monetary free-for-all and the need to establish order again within the monetary system. Do you remember the conversation we had with Giulio Gallerotti? Brilliant guy, teaches on the East Coast. And what he said, I recall, is, no, we'll never go back to a gold standard, but we might, out of necessity, given the circumstances, be required to accept disciplines that reflect the same kinds of disciplines that were present under the gold standard.
Well, and under the current banking system, you know, it reminds me, if you're actually trading in bullion, it's because the bankers caused the problem in the first place. And so it reminds me a little bit of, you know, an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting group meeting in a bar. That just doesn't make a lot of sense. Okay, if the bar caused the addiction, if the banks caused the addiction to debt, why in the world do you need to go to a bank to transact? I mean, the banking system is an addictive system, and they want to keep that control. And you know, there is a bias though, Dave. There's a bias. We've all been trained that when we have extra money, we go put it in the bank. But the banking system is not necessarily the end all. And like you said, there may be a discipline that comes down the pike down the road. I think part of the cryptocurrencies is this, you know, buried deep within the cryptocurrency movement is this need to get away from a debt driven currency.
Right.
And that's the banking system.
And so the fascination is with some sort of limits being placed on that expansion. So,
exactly.
You know, my view though still, and I'm going to sidestep the cryptocurrency thing for a second, because to me, still, if the system is not going to provide a gold standard for you, I think it's incumbent upon you, the investor, don't wait for the banking system to accommodate and accept bullion.
Put yourself on a gold standard.
Put yourself on a gold standard. Yeah. And banks might not be willing to accept gold, but I think we can save and denominate our savings accordingly. Now, I do know of a few small regional banks in the Southeast who are considering using the product that we're introducing to the market this year and next, which is a savings program, a digital savings program, which allows you to save in gold ounces. And you can access that digitally. You can create liquidity for yourself instantaneously. Your settlement's in less than 3 days. So
right.
Better than a stock settlement.
So it's like owning cash in gold. It's not necessarily owning physical gold in your hand, but it is like owning cash in gold.
That's right. Now, the fascinating thing for us has been to see banks who are interested in the product, because they do have savers who occasionally want a different quote-unquote denomination.
Right. Yeah,
so is it a gold product? Yes and no. I mean, yes, it's gold that is the product, but the mechanisms and the styling of it are such that it is simply a cash alternative and ultimately a banking system alternative. And I think those banks who are courting this product and us on it are really saying, we recognize that sometimes confidence wanes and we want to maintain legitimacy with our clients, regardless of normal times or abnormal times. And these are bankers who are thinking outside of the box, and it will serve them well in years and decades ahead.
All right, then, Dave, that takes me to the next question, and it has to do with storage facilities, storing gold and silver. He says, just one question, just wondering, if you buy gold and silver and then decide to store it in one of the several storage facilities available, then what stops the government sending the army to confiscate that gold and silver? You know, probably saying, quote, this is good for the country and it's good for the people, end quote. That's just a thought. I'm no expert. But let's just take Bitcoin. Where do they confiscate that? So start with the gold and silver, and then he's asking, is there going to be a Bitcoin confiscation as well?
Well, I want to reverse it and actually start with Bitcoin and then move to gold and silver, because I think you actually have the same kinds of vulnerability, whether you know it or not. Bitcoin has to be stored someplace. Okay, so you're talking about servers and mainframes which contain these digital units, right? And you can prevent hackability if you're willing to take those servers or mainframes offline. And that's really your only protection. Now, the reality is that is still, that code is still sitting in a spatial location and is just as vulnerable. I mean, if you had $1 million in Bitcoin on your office computer here, Kevin, and you left it unplugged in order for it to be unhackable, right. I can walk away with your computer and I can walk away with your $1 million in Bitcoin.
Guys keep it on their thumb drives and it can happen too.
That's exactly right. So there is the hackability issue. And as we've already seen, one of the largest holders of Bitcoin is the FBI. Now, why is the FBI one of the largest holders of Bitcoin? Because they took it from the quote unquote Dread Pirate Roberts. Mm. You know, back when they had the whole Silk Road issue and, you know, people are funding, you know, you want to snuff somebody out, we can do it. I mean, there was sort of a black market in all things, whether it was drugs or guns or, you know, you need to kill somebody. That's essentially what this person under the pseudonym Dread Pirate Roberts was facilitating. And Bitcoin was the currency of choice. That's why the FBI has.
That's why the FBI has confiscated.
No, wait a minute. How is it confiscated? How did they get it?
Right.
Did they get it digitally or did they get it because they took the mainframe? My point is that you have the same exact spatial vulnerability with Bitcoin as you do with gold and silver. The question is, do people know where it is? Do people know where it is?
Right.
And I'm willing to a certain degree to say, I've got silver in Toronto. Gold in
Zurich.
Ottawa.
You've got some in Zurich.
In Zurich.
In Ottawa.
Silver in Delaware.
Right.
I mean, these are things that I'm okay with people knowing. Now, there's some gold and silver that I have that people don't know about.
Right.
And so that's, you know, if you don't know it, where it is, you can't find it. And I think this comes down to willingness to cooperate. In the 1930s, when gold was confiscated, 10% of the outstanding gold was handed in. And that's an interesting thing because you were threatened with 10 years of a prison sentence and $10,000 fines. Again, 90% of the gold outstanding stayed outstanding. 10% was handed in. That says to me that in spite of confiscation and the threat thereof, it still was a question of, are you going to go looking and find it?
Right. And that was a national confiscation. If you think about it, the whole world is probably not going to comply to a United States confiscation.
Right. And it always is going to be a question, going back to the point of, couldn't our army just go and get it? Well, sure, if they wanted to.
Right.
You know, but the question is, at what cost? And you can go even back for historical precedent here. Hitler knew that there was enough gold in Switzerland to fund the moves of the Third Reich, and he needed that gold. But he also knew that it would cost him 6 months and that the Blitzkrieg could not afford a 6 month delay picking up the gold necessary to fund his organization, operation, et cetera, et cetera. Did he make the right move or the wrong move? Well, eventually he started to run out of cash, which debilitated his ultimate victory.
Well, by the time you get to gold confiscations, like you're talking about with Hitler, you probably have already had a currency devaluation or complete destruction. So, you know, you have to look at things like a series of dominoes falling. Yeah, anything is possible, but how many steps down that process? Like you said, the 6 month delay, that was an issue. Okay. You want to try to find ways of having a backup plan. You know, the Apollo space program used triple redundancy for any of the life systems. So they said, all right, well, we don't know that this system won't go out, but we've got two backup systems behind that.
And for me, it's quintuple redundancy.
Okay. There you go.
Because what I want is gold in five places so that if I ever do face this particular risk of a forced seizure of the asset, they may get 20%, whoever they may be. I mean, this could be the Swiss government. It could be the Canadian government. It could be the U.S. government. But that's what they'll get is 20%. The other 80 remains. So I'm going to limit my risk to this threat by creating enough geographic and institutional diversification. You mentioned NASA and triple redundancy. I prefer quintuple redundancy when it comes to my hard-earned assets.
Right. Okay. Well, next question. Wouldn't gold stocks give you a better return than gold? He says selling stocks is easy. Selling physical gold looks more difficult, and you could have large fees, especially if you're using eBay. Now, is that a fair comparison? I mean, are gold stocks a substitution for gold, Dave, or should they be used for, you know, what they're best for, each one?
Yeah, I don't think they're a substitute in the sense that gold is a store of value. Gold stocks are not a store of value. Gold stocks are a speculation on the demand for that store of value.
Hmm.
And so if you have an increase in demand for gold, the price goes up. And the speculation in gold stocks is that as the price of gold rises, the profitability of the companies mining it goes up on an exponential basis because of supply inelasticity in the gold market. So I look at them as two different but complementary assets. I own gold and silver shares, and those companies will not do well in the context of a stagnating gold market, silver market, and they will do extraordinarily well, typically 3, 5, 10, even 20 times performance, depending on the company, relative to bullion. But wouldn't gold stocks give you a better return than gold? That's a question I just gave an answer to. Right. Yes, they would. But you first have to ask the question, what are you asking your dollars to do for you? Because it's a totally different mandate. Rank speculation, which absolutely gold shares are a rank speculation. They can be a reasonable rank speculation. They can be very reasonable,
right.
But that's different than the mandate given to gold, which is preservation of value. And I think too many people think they must speculate to see gains versus, as one of our friends, Rand Crowley, used to say, let it come to you.
Right.
Let it come to you. What do I mean by that in this context? Well, to own gold and see a deflationary collapse in various asset prices, you maintain and increase purchasing power. Going back to the 1929 to 32 period, what you had was, because of the compression in values in stocks and bonds, an increase, relatively speaking, to gold of nearly 250%. If you want to read on this, you can through Roy Jastrom's book, The Golden Constant, where he documents better than 6 instances of gold holding its own in the context of deflations, anywhere from 50% increase in purchasing power to 250% increase in purchasing power. So you can see gains by buying quality assets at depressed prices, moving from gold, which has represented stability for you in the context of that crisis, just moving laterally out of gold into depressed assets and allowing those assets to return to full value. Case in point, if you bought the Dow in 1932 and rode it to 1937, you had a 400% gain. So not only a 250% gain in purchasing power between 29 and 32 for the gold holder, increase in purchasing power, but then if you made the lateral move out of gold into shares, you had a 400% gain on top of that by buying the undervalued asset and riding a cyclical bull trend in regular Dow Jones Industrial Average shares. So to me, gold gave you one of the best offenses, but it was inherently defensive in nature. And it was not a speculation to ultimately see in a decade's time 500 to 1,000% gain. Does that make sense?
Well, and it makes sense too, Dave. You know, the physical gold, if a person is in physical gold in any generation since the beginning of mankind, they still have an ounce of gold. It doesn't go away. Now, you know how many mines have gone out of business through the years. So, yes, gold shares can give you a better return. But what you're saying, just like you were with compounding ounces, you want to look for the better value and you want to make sure that you're not trying to just speculate or just hedge or just retain value.
Well, and here's one of the reasons why gold shares can go down in the context of a crisis. If they're sold off indiscriminately as the stock market sells off, what if gold goes down too? Gold can go down, and that would be one of the reasons why gold shares would go down too, because they'd say, well, the profitability of these companies is in free fall. I'm looking at gold relative to the Dow Jones Industrial Average on a relative basis and see that opportunity to increase on the basis of purchasing power, right? That doesn't mean the price of gold can't go down in the context of deflation. I know this may sound like a bunny trail, but gold stocks have their place. You just have to recognize they are a speculation. Gold is a different animal altogether. Now, to that last issue of large fees, especially if you use eBay, sure. Well, eBay wasn't designed first and foremost to be a broker of gold and silver. That's something that we've done since 1972. When my mother started the company and then my dad ultimately came back and joined her in that endeavor, and the two of them ran that business. I mean, we're talking about a mom and pop business run out of our basement in 1972. Now with a large office and more people than you can shake a stick at, we have grown through 45 years considerably. The question is, why would you be buying metals on eBay?
Or selling them on eBay.
Yeah, but you have no proof of provenance. I mean, there's a whole host of issues. If I was afraid of corrupted bars or something that was counterfeited by the Chinese, I would not be buying on eBay. eBay is not guaranteeing that this product isn't counterfeit.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, whereas our sources, all of them are mints, governments who are directly accountable to us and must replace faulty product if, in case there is ever faulty product. And last time I checked, we've never had an issue.
Well, not to mention our on-site in-house numismatist who's been here for 36 years, Drew Kroll. Yep. Well, Dave, for the sake of time, I'd like to give you the next question that we're going to actually answer next week, because we've got plenty of other questions that we'd like to get to. The next question from Terry says, if gold does go up, like Mr. King says, she's writing this after the Bill King interview, she says, what do you buy?
Well, that's a good question. I know exactly the answer to that, but let's save that for next week. We've got about a dozen or more questions for next week as well from our YouTube channel, and appreciate those coming in. We have all that we can take right now, but hopefully this sort of scratches where you had an itch in terms of wanting some specific answers to specific things that are lingering on your mind.
Well, and we wish you a happy new year, this upcoming new year. Before we talk to you next, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can always call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.